Life sure gets busy, doesn't it? Well, we understand. With all the certifications you have, finding the right kind of continuing education that fits your schedule can be a real challenge. That's where the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription comes in. For less than $5 a month, the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription gives you top-notch accredited CE while you listen. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information or to sign up today. The FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription, another way we're being your partner in discovery.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey, everybody. Mike Verkess sitting in for Eric Bauer this week on this episode of the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. And I'm super happy to be back. And it's pretty serendipitous, actually, that I'm sitting here with you because if we go back about 4 years to episode 58 that originally aired on May 15th, 2015, there was a brand new study kicking off from the Resuscitation's Outcomes Consortium. And that was the very first podcast that I ever did with Mr. Eric Bauer on the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. And it was super amazing. And from there really launched the second shift and a number of other little things that I've had the pleasure of working with Eric on since then. But guess what? The results of the TXA and TBI are in, and I'm excited to share those with you as we continue with this episode. One of the things I'm always asked is, what in the heck is ROC, or what was ROC? What was the Resuscitation's Outcomes Consortium? And basically, the mission of the Resuscitation Consortium was really to provide an infrastructure, provide project support for clinical trials in the pre-hospital setting. And they really focused on a couple of specific areas. One of them was cardiopulmonary arrest and then severe traumatic injury. The whole point of the consortium was to really try to bring about evidence-based changes that made real clinical practice changes out there. So a lot of pre-hospital focus, early hospitalization interventions, things like that. And really what they did was a bunch of collaborative trials of variable sizes and duration. And they really did a good job of equaling out things from the cardiac arrest side to the trauma side. And they really had a great network of clinical centers, data centers, and things like that that really helped ROC be successful during the time that it was going. I had the opportunity to work with ROC on a number of programs, but really they were really interested in novel programs to figure out hemorrhage control strategies, cerebral protection, neurologic preservation, using metabolically directed therapies or alternate methods of like delivering CPR defibrillation. So I'll go through a number of the studies that we did, but I really wanted to just give a shout out to all the folks of ROC that really did an amazing job throughout its tenure of existence out there. So regional clinical centers were Dallas-Fort Worth Center for Resuscitation Research, the Milwaukee Resuscitation Center, the Ottawa, Ontario Resuscitation Center, British Columbia Resuscitation Research Center, the Pittsburgh Resuscitation Network, right here in Oregon, the Oregon Health and Sciences University, Portland Resuscitation's Outcomes Consortium, which is what I was a part of and very proud of that. Seattle King County Center for Resuscitation and Research at the University of Washington, Alabama Resuscitation Center, the Toronto Regional Resuscitation Research Out of Hospital Network, and UCSD in San Diego, the San Diego Resuscitation and Research Center. Now, many of the satellite areas that were around the country that really helped kick things off were the Memphis Resuscitation Research Center, the San Francisco Clinical Center, Cincinnati Clinical Center, Houston Clinical Center, the Houston Data Coordinating Center, Toronto Sunnybrook Clinical Center, and then the list goes on and on. Tucson, Los Angeles, St. Paul, Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and of course, Hennepin County in Minneapolis were major players in the Resuscitation's Outcomes Consortium. So again, I was super proud to be a part of that. I know a number of our colleagues that we find out in the FOMED world were also part of the Resuscitation's Outcomes Consortium, and they have lost funding. The funding has ran out for ROC, but you can still check out their website. So if you just type in your Google searches, ROC EMS research, you will get to their homepage from the University of Washington. You'll be able to see all the different studies that we did. And again, it was just a pleasure to be involved in ROC because they made such a huge contribution to pre-hospital emergency care. And really from the research side was the only thing really going. So huge kudos to all the folks at ROC. So let's jump in and actually recap a little bit of episode 58 and a little about the studies that actually led us to the TXA and TBI talk. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you all about TXA. There are plenty of FlavorJed podcasts to go back and listen to if you want to learn more about TXA or maybe get a refresher on the mechanism of action, how it's applied, all that kind of stuff. So you can find plenty of episodes to do that. But the two hallmark studies that really landed TXA in your aircraft or on your unit on the ground were Crash 2 and Matters. And actually, just as a side note, Crash 3 just finished up. So it'll be interesting to see what they find out. But what we know from Crash 2 and Matters is that there was plenty of benefit if TXA was given early, and it was pretty harmful, actually, if it was given late. So the studies in their entirety, if you want to go look at Crash 2 and Matters, if you go to the FlavorJed website, find episode 58, click on that, and then scroll all the way to the bottom. You can find all the studies in their entirety in the show notes. So that's where you can find those. So let's talk a little bit about the history and prevalence of traumatic brain injury. Now, according to the CDC, the rates of TBI ED visits by mechanism of injury from 2006 to 2014 are skyrocketing, right? So if you look at just mechanism of injury, things like assault or unintentional injury, things like that, or motor vehicle crashes, those have all remained fairly stable during the during this time. But the one area that has gone through the roof is falls, unintentional falls, and they've gone up about 80% between 2006 and 2014. And that is huge. So from 208.8 to 374.9 per thousand, per 100,000 increase for TBI related ED visits as a result of intentional self-harm. So 60%, that's pretty huge, right? Now, if we go back and actually look at hospital emergency department visits, hospitalization, so admits and death data, it's absolutely on the rise. In fact, it went from about 1.5 million cases to nearly 3 million cases in 2014. And the reality is, from the pre-hospital perspective, there is not a ton we can do about TBI, right? Now, there's a few things we can manage. So before you go judging, let me finish what I'm going to say. All of the attempts that we do in EMS, fire, law enforcement, Safe Kids Coalition, all these different things that are out there is we want to prevent that primary injury from occurring. And how do we do that? There's a million things that we all do. Car seat clinics, bike helmet giveaways, fall window prevention. We go in and look at people's homes and make sure they don't have tripping hazards and things like that. So we really want to prevent that primary injury from occurring. And the reason why is once it is occurred, the process has started. So what we can do and what we're in direct control of is really preventing those secondary injuries. So there's a lot we can do to prevent those secondary injuries. So we're going to manage hypotension, hypoxia, hypercarbia, controlling seizures. So lots we can do once it's already happened, but really that primary injury, there's not much we can do. So let's back up a little bit and talk about MATTERS, the MATTERS trial. So this was the military equivalent, and I'm using this very loosely, of the Crash 2. So this is Crash 2 was civilian, Matters was military. Nested with inside that study, there was a group of people that were administered TXA that seemed to have really good outcomes, and that was folks with isolated traumatic brain injury. So they had no hypotension, they were normotensive, but had isolated head injuries, and they seemed to do really well. So what the Resuscitation's Outcomes Consortium did was said, we wonder if this would actually translate over into the civilian population, and we should do a study on that. So that is how we ended up doing the study of TXA and TBI. Okay, so the outcome of the TXA and TBI study was really to just determine the effects of two dosing strategies of TXA. So two ways we're going to give it. And this was, they were looking at outcome following moderate to severe traumatic brain injury. And we'll get into this because this was interesting. And this is something, if you've taken a review course and you've listened to my neuro talk, this plays right into that because I mentioned this a lot. So let's talk a little bit about the study itself. So it was a three-armed randomized trial. So it was 1-to-1-to-1. It was multi-center, so it was all over the United States. So rock centers from all over participated. It was in both North America. Well, I should say it was in the entirety of North America, so Canada, United States. The study was double-blinded, and basically we had key-coded kits that were on the rigs, and then when we used one or enrolled a patient, we were able to essentially just go and replace that when we got to the trauma center. Okay, so let's talk about who was going to be included in the study. So the inclusion criteria was blunt or penetrating TBI. They had to have a GCS between 3 and 12. Now, I want you to remember that because we're going to come back to that in just a second. Their blood pressure, they had to have a systolic blood pressure of greater than 90. They had to be 15 years or older or greater than 50 kilograms if you couldn't, you know, if you didn't know how old they were. They had to have an IV. And interestingly enough, we could not enroll somebody if we could only get an IO because TXA, for the safety study, the purposes of the study, it was intravenous only. It was not intraosseous. So pretty interesting. And then they had to be taken to a participating hospital. So for us, we have two level ones in Portland, Oregon, and they had to go to Oregon Health Sciences University. So that was it, basically. If you met those criteria, you were going to be enrolled in the study, and we were going to see how things work. Now, let's go over the exclusion criteria, because you know there's typically way more exclusion criteria, which can create a problem if you're the one in the field trying to remember all this stuff, right? Because you wouldn't have had a 3 or 4 hour training. Now you have someone with a traumatic brain injury, and now you're trying to remember what in the hell is going on. So it's very interesting. So if they had a GCS of 3 with non-reactive pupils, they were out. If it was greater than 2 hours from the time of injury, or you didn't know when they were injured, they were out. If they had CPR of any kind in the pre-hospital setting, they were out. If you knew they had seizures, history of an MI, stroke, or they were on dialysis, they were going to be out. And of course, we always had the known or suspected prisoners, known or suspected pregnancy. If it was a drowning or a hanging, they were out. Burns greater than 20% total body surface area, they were out. Or if they had an opt-out bracelet on, which in order to do a study on human beings, if you've never been involved in one of those, when you're doing a study that is going to go on implied consent, then you have the opportunity to attend a community meeting and actually opt out of the study. And so if you were going to do that, you basically had to wear a wristband, a bracelet, metal bracelet, that basically said opt out on it. And you had to wear that everywhere because you never know when this primary TBI is going to occur. It could be walking out to check the mail, could be traveling to work or whatever. So if people did not want in on an exception from informed consent study, they had to wear this bracelet all the time. So this is basically what they were going to do as far as randomization. There was 3 groups, as I mentioned, and this is what they were. So it was a 2-gram pre-hospital bolus, and then an 8-hour in-hospital placebo infusion. Then that was the first arm. Second arm was 1-gram pre-hospital bolus, an 8-hour in-hospital 1-gram infusion, or it was a placebo in the pre-hospital setting, and then an 8-hour in-hospital placebo setting for the hospital. So we had 2 grams and then a placebo. Then we had 1 gram and then 1 gram. And then we had a placebo plus a placebo. Again, double blind, no one knew. And of course, if there was a safety concern, we could obviously unblind it and that creates a whole situation, but it can be done. So pretty interesting thing. And I got to say, I was super privileged to work with Dr. Mohammed Daya out of OHSU, and we wrote the training curriculum for this. So it was pretty cool. All right, so the study kicked off and we were on our way. After a few delays, you know, if you're dealing with the Department of Defense and a number of other agencies out there, everyone's got their own IRB and we're running through IRB after IRB. We finally got the green light and we started going. And what we found was super, super interesting. If you remember our inclusion criteria, they had to have a GCS between 3 and 12. All right, so 12 or less, basically. Here was the catch, and we did not anticipate this. And I think this lends itself to a number of discussions I've been seeing on social media, and that is the use of the Glasgow Coma Scale and our ability to actually use it correctly. So very interesting. We found ourselves enrolling patients incorrectly, and it was all because we configured the GCS incorrectly. And again, if you've ever participated in the medical studies with human beings in it. Turns out you just can't enroll the wrong people, right? That is a huge red flag. They will shut you down in a heartbeat. So what we found ourselves doing was having to get back, regroup, and actually train everybody in how to do a correct Glasgow Coma Scale. So it was very, very, very interesting. And sort of at the same time, there was an interesting study that Dr. Brian Bledsoe did in the Las Vegas area, where they came up with about 10 or 15 little 15 to 30 second clips of a scenario. And they asked people to write down what they thought the GCS was. By the way, you can find these little snippets on YouTube if you just Google it. And it turns out that we are good at exactly three different GCSs. We pretty much nail three. That's easy. We almost always nail 15. But there was one more that we were really good at, and that was 14. So if you are 3, 14, or 15, we can nail it every time. If it's anything other than that, we are all over the place as providers. So we had patients being entered what they thought was a 10, but they were really a 14. We had patients being entered in as a 12, but they were really 14. And it was just really all over the place. So at the end of the day, what we decided we had to do was literally just print out a card that had all the criteria to configure a GCS. And what most people were having trouble, or trouble, I guess is not the right word, but it was really choosing the patient's best response in each one of those categories. And one of the little snippets that really gets people every single time, because when we have time in class, I will do this, is a guy that has some repetitive questioning after a motor vehicle accident. He knows exactly what happened to him. He knows exactly where he is. But then he comes back and says, well, what happened? I was in a car wreck. Okay, well, where was it? Well, you said it was at Walmart. That's right, it was at Walmart. And so he is really a GCS of 15, because repetitive questioning does not reflect it in the GCS, but people always wanted to mark him down lower. So that was just an example and one of the challenges we had when we were going through the inclusion criteria for making this happen. So this is the results. Let me just jump back into the results. Okay, so enrollment was from May of 2015 to March of 2017. There were 967 patients randomized and received a drug. And they did a really good job of equal people in each arm. So we had 346 people in the first arm, 312 in the second, and 309, which was the placebo for both. And so that was a really good little spread. So this is what we found. And they were looking at survival, 28-day survival in this study. And it was pretty interesting. So if you look at intracerebral hemorrhage patients through the first 30 days of post-admission, the folks that got the 2-gram bolus only in the field had a significantly better control of their intracerebral hemorrhage. They did better. And if you went through the first 72 hours with that, they did significantly better with that 2-gram bolus. So the other arms were essentially equal. Placebo was the same as the 1-gram and the 1-gram, but the 2-gram bolus pre-hospital had an amazing effect. Okay, so this is brand new information, guys. This is just hitting the press just now. The paper is not out yet. There's just a public release of it. So this is what we found. The pre-hospital TXA use is actually feasible. Not only is it feasible in this situation, but it's probably going to be beneficial. They found that it does not affect the TEG on admission. And the 2-gram pre-hospital TXA result improved 28-day survival in patients with intracerebral hemorrhage. And this is the kicker right here. This is the first therapeutic with evidence for benefit in acute TBI pretty much ever. Okay, so let me say that again. It is a first therapeutic intervention with evidence for benefit in acute TBI that there has ever been. So this is really big news, guys, really big news. And there's going to be a lot to follow. There's going to be a lot more information coming out with this, but I thought it was super important that we get this information out to you as soon as we can. I'm going to attach this slide deck that I'm looking at here to the show notes, so you'll be able to see exactly what I'm saying. And it's just a great time for pre-hospital research. And if you're interested in that, stay tuned to FlightBridge Ed, because we have some amazing things, some amazing announcements coming in May that we're going to debut at FAST 19. We hope we're going to get to see you there. So just for this is going to do it for this particular episode. Appreciate you guys listening in. Appreciate Eric letting me take the mic here and share this information with you. So again, hope to see you at FAST 19. Other than that, you guys take care, and we will see you soon.
This has been a production of the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.